How many people we got?
You, me, and Laurie.
Okay. This is the NLA Hams Net. It happens every week at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm going to get my handy-dandy, nifty-thrifty water bottle here. And we are here to discuss ham issues in regards to the NLA. Anything so open for the floor? And, Laurie, I'd like to know if you have anything you want to cover. I know Jan has his ham license. I have my ham license. And I've been trying to get everybody to contact the local ham. Laurie, are you there?
No, she just dropped out here a minute ago.
Oh,
there she comes back.
Okay. Laurie, you there?
I think she just picked up her mic.
That sounds like it.
Nope. She went away again. She must be having trouble getting on because she dropped out again.
What I figured was is that since this is between the holidays,
right.
I don't expect as many people to be on. And I wanted to just get a feeling from everyone of what would be their challenge to get them going. Because I really want to get... go ahead, Laurie.
Well, excuse me. I have some problems. I have had horrible, horrible static and everything. So I hung up twice and tried to call back in.
Well, we're glad
finally
you're
connected.
Here. We're glad you're here. Have you made any progress talking about hams?
Yeah. No.
Okay. No sweat.
I've been too busy doing everything else.
How can we help you? What would help you get going?
A good report from yeah. No, that's okay.
A good report from what?
That's okay. I was just talking.
Okay. Well, I want to encourage you to get in touch with the local ham group. There's plenty in the Denver area. Let's get going. How hard was the test for you, Jan?
Well, I signed up and work at it on the net, and I just went through the first exam, and I never actually took the sample quiz at the end. I just worked through the questions until they said I knew enough of the answers to the questions that I should go take the test. And so then I started working on the second test and did the same thing. So then I went in the following Monday, I guess it was, and took both exams and passed them. And then the next month, each month, we meet the second Tuesday of the month. And other than one special meeting a year, they offer the testing every other month. So I went in and... to take the extra exam. Now, the extra exam I thought was more difficult. I sat and went through the questions on the web, and then I started taking the exams. And I worked through all the exams. I don't know, I worked through five or six of them. But when I went in that night, I found about seven questions on that exam that weren't in the material I'd been studying. I don't know if they've updated it just recently or what. But anyway, I had enough of the correct answers, so I passed it. But I thought that the last one was more difficult, which is what you would kind of expect, you know. But
yeah.
I think if I were to do it again, I would do it the same way. I would sign up, and I think it was $25 for the first exam and $30 for the second on the web, and go through, and they'll tell you how you're doing. And it's kind of neat because those questions that you miss, you can set how frequently they re-ask them. So you can recycle them until you get them. And when you get them, then you can go on. When they pop up, just go on to the next question. So they keep reminding you of those things which you're not clear on. Sometimes it's the frequency bands, things like that, which is peer memorization, which I do not like. which I am not good at. So it was good that they keep throwing it at you till you learn it, and they move on. So to me, that was probably the best and easy way for me to get through the exams and still retain a goodly amount of the information. Over.
Well, thank you. So you have your extra now, huh?
Yep. I'm all extra sized.
Okay. Well, then you know as much as I do.
No, I don't think so. You've been doing this a good many years. Your C stories are far in excess of anything I have.
Laurie, can we answer any questions that you might have?
No. I'm just on hold out here. I've just got too many other things that I'm doing. I'm staying in touch, but that's about it. I got two ham clubs that I've been attending their meetings. So, but I haven't gotten anything.
Wow, well, that's a big thing. That's a big thing to go to two ham clubs.
Yeah,
it's amazing. That's great. Thank you. Continue to go.
Well, yeah. Because they're so close by, over.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I encourage you to keep going. Do you have any other new people or other people on the call?
Yes, we have several others have recently popped in. If you want to take another list.
Sure. Go ahead. You might want to talk. Does anybody have any questions or items they'd like to get? Just identify yourself and ask a question or make a comment.
Hi, Terry. This is Helena in Pittsburgh.
Well, hi, Helena.
Hi, how are you? I still don't have my ham radio. I'm sorry, holidays, and I have to pay taxes on two properties, and oh my gosh, I thought by now I'd have it, but I'm just listening, so I'm going to push my own mute button so I don't start the pepper grinder like the last time. So I do apologize, but you're always full of wonderful information, and I'm learning and I'm looking up the stuff on the websites like you told me, and thank you for helping me. I appreciate it. I'm going to mute myself, though.
Okay. Do we have any other comments, suggestions, check-ins, whatever you'd like to do? Come, please call now.
Yeah, this is Greg in Florida checking in.
Well, hi, Greg. It's good to hear from you.
Thanks, you too. I haven't got any progress. I'm still just listening in, and you know, like I said, I'm doing the app on the phone, but I'm not done with anything enough to take a test, so...
Okay.
Got a few other things preoccupying me.
I understand. And that's what always happens. I just want to reiterate that I would like to hear from everybody who comes on this call what kind of challenge would help you, each of you, get going. How could I help you? Any ideas?
Well, my idea would be maybe go over a few questions a week, and then, you know, that would be about it, just a slow progress for people who aren't licensed yet. That's all.
Okay. So when you say go over things, you mean I should take a section in the book for a few questions or anything in particular?
Yeah, I think just something just so anybody who hasn't passed the test might know the formats of it, the questions, that's all. Maybe just a little nudge.
Okay.
You know, if I might make a suggestion, one of the things that I found fascinating was the propagation phenomenon that you get into and deal with bounces off the different layers of the atmosphere and the frequencies that you can use to exploit those. Maybe next week, if you have some time, you might lecture us a little bit on how we can use that to communicate the longer ranges without the use of repeaters and that sort of thing. Over. Still there, Terry?
Yeah, it helps if I unmute myself. I was coughing so much I didn't want to. You know, I
pulled Great conversation.
Gerard. Yeah, I pulled a Gerard, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good idea. So I'll talk maybe next week I'll talk about HF layers.
Yeah,
and what layers are active, what layers there are, and we'll just go through that little, it's about 3 or 4 pages in the ARRL book, HF
right.
layers. And let's see, characteristics.
It might provide some incentive for people, you know, once they get into a little bit with a little Bofang to go into the HF band.
Yeah, and it does take a little more effort. At the beginning, their HF was about all we had. Some of you might have heard of a spark gap transmitter. Does anybody know anything about a spark gap transmitter?
Only in acoustics.
Only in acoustics.
Yep, they make a wonderful transient.
A wonderful what?
Transient. Impulse in the water.
You lost me.
it's one way to generate a real high amplitude, broad spectrum signal in the water. You have a little spark gap in the water, and you charge up a capacitor until it has enough energy to pop across that gap. It goes boom, and you can hear that probably halfway across the ocean if you're in the right, at the right depth when you do that.
Yeah, that's one of the things they found, that if you have a noise, it's hard to tell where it's coming from unless you know the characteristics of the water, because you get different temperature layers, and it can duct and go several times further than it would normally go. And my dad used to have, we used to have one of those old cranky telephone generators. And
right.
He would tell me he could throw a plug in over there and a plug in over there and ring up central. All the fish come to the top, and then he could gather them with a net.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was illegal after a while. But anyway.
I wouldn't be surprised.
A spark gap transmitter is exactly what you were describing. You would turn on an AC signal and at a particular frequency, and you would make it jump a gap. You'd have enough power to where it would jump a small gap. Well, anybody who has studied radio waves knows that the composition of a square wave, which is a instantaneous up constant and instantaneous down, has what, all odd multiples of frequencies. So you're on every single frequency. And that's one of the things that they faced in the early 20th century. And I was reading about this last week. It's very, very interesting that everybody was using spark gap transmitters and nobody could really talk. And that kind of led a step at a time. Also, I was reading about the Navy ships and how they progressed. And they were complaining, the Navy was complaining, that they were having some of the naval stations along the coast were complaining that the amateurs, that they had better equipment than the Navy did, doing better things, and that they'd get walked on. And it was often times where somebody that was an amateur could hear the signal and pass the message along for the Navy. Wouldn't that be embarrassing if you were in the Navy? But that happened. There's some old stuff that you can look up on the net and see kind of the development. And as it got better, those old stations, they weren't sure how to produce the power that you needed to get across an ocean. And some of these transmitters were the size of a small room. And then over the years, so it developed rather quickly, but 5 or 6 years, they had it down to a refrigerator size. another 10 years, they had it down to where it was just a box that could sit up on a table. And after that, it was you could get it pretty small. They didn't exactly know how the tubes worked until the teens. Tubes weren't used extensively until maybe the 20s. But it was all a learning experience and continually learning. So it's fascinating to get on and read some of those things. And I won't take your time up doing that, but that's really where the heart of the amateur radio service began. We wanted to help, and they found out that the amateurs were making faster advances in radio technology than were the military or the scholars or anybody else. Well, that's kind of proven to be true in other fields as well, that amateurs interested, you have more people trying more things, and you tend to get better ones. Unless somebody's just really super smart in a scholastic area or a government area, that could make some progress that maybe other people had not thought of. And the idea that this station was interfering with that station was a very bad thing in the aughts, in the early 1900s. And it kind of died off during the war, and then it came back in spades in the 20s because a lot more people got interested in radio. But even that, the FCC was created, and they said, we need to kind of start coordinating this. And the ITU regions were created so that not everybody would interfere. And the ham bands were created, and the amateurs wanted to do their part. And so they kind of quit using all the other bands. And it's been a workable situation. Since HF goes all over the world, that's kind of why they reserve HF for the higher classes of licenses in ham radio, amateur radio, because the potential for interfering is much greater. There's a radio station overseas that when they kick in 40 meters on that frequency, just kind of shuts down. You got to go off frequency several hertz before you can hear again. And if I could encourage anybody to get, you know, get a radio, get a cheap radio, you can get a single sideband radio for about $150. Listen a lot. You can go cheaper and get one that doesn't do single sideband, but you'll be amazed at how much stuff you can listen to from around the world on long wave and short wave. Okay, do we have any questions or new check-ins? This might be a very short meeting if this continues. Yes.
Well, we do have people that haven't checked in, but to add a comment to what you were talking about with the hams at the turn of the century, it's always interesting when you come up with a technical field and the amateurs pick it up and they don't know what doesn't work. A lot of times the people in the scholastic areas and research areas have done enough stuff so they know what doesn't work and what works, and so they follow what they think works, and so they miss all of those things. You know, they don't try a lot of different things, and as a result, they don't make a lot of discoveries that the amateurs pick up just because they didn't know it didn't work, and so they went ahead and did it, you know? And you see that happening all the time, which is interesting. Over.
Oh, good point, Jan. Thank you. Absolutely. And even now, I see people, you know, experimenting with large radio dishes. pointed at the another place. You know, they're up on the 10 to 20 or 30 gigahertz range, and it only takes a tiny little amount of power, but it's definitely line of sight. If you don't have your receive antenna and your transmit antenna point exactly at each other, you don't hear it. And yet you can hear the tiniest little signal when you're lined up, and it's really high quality audio. But you almost have to have a friend who wants to work it with you, and you both have to be hams on both ends. But that's getting into the upper echelons of what's available. I don't know. Did anybody get to get up and see W0DK? That's Whiskey Zero Delta Kilo .org this week. Anybody take a look at the square kilometer array or anything like that?
Terry, could you repeat that, because I missed last week's meeting and I didn't catch the dot org.
Okay. Whiskey Zero Delta Kilo, W0DK.org. And I'll look it up just to make sure that I've got it right. Whiskey Zero Delta Kilo. Oh, it's up on QSLNet. Well, it's actually www.qsl.net/W0DK. But if you look up W0DK on any of your browsers, it'll pop right to the top. It's the Boulder Amateur Radio Club, or BARC is what it's called.
W what? WZK?
W0DK. Maybe I should talk about the way call signs are constructed. You have either one or two letters. Everything starts with a K, a W, an A, or an N in America. Then there's a zero. The zero, or the number, indicates a region of our country. And then the second part is either one, two, or three letters. Those are issued. They are unique around the world. They're coordinated with the ITU, so nobody else uses the types of messages that, or the types of call signs that we put together in the U.S., and they're unique. So W0DK has been around about 70 years, and it's the Boulder Amateur Radio Club. And if you're on that site, there's a KM to the power of 2 array. A square kilometer array, and it uses something that you're using every day that you might not know about. And that is that there's two ways to knock down the noise. Now, what they've done with these arrays is they're pointing them all in one direction, and they use a whole bunch of them because each one will have a little bit different noise level in it. And because of that, they can average out the noise level and really drive it down to where it's almost non-existent. The very large array out in western New Mexico uses a similar tactic with 27, I think it is, three directions, nine antennas each, just 27. It was featured in the film First Contact, where the Jodie Foster, she was laying on her car listening, and all of a sudden she heard a signal that didn't make any sense, and that ooh, that has to be, that's not a signal you hear in nature. And so that kicked off the whole show from there. But she was sitting on a car, and behind her you saw a dish. Well, that was one of the dishes at the VLA, the very large array out in western Mexico. If you look out past Socorro on the highway going west into Arizona, you can see it on Google Earth. I've looked it up several times. It's just kind of interesting. And when you go out there, one of the arms of that VLA crosses the highway about a mile from the control station. So they use the same thing there. Everything's pointing, but because it's at a different place, you can knock down the noise by through statistical methods. And so they can hear a lot better. And those 27 antennas spaced out the entire way give you the equivalent of a dish that same diameter. The same thing they're doing with the square kilometer array, and it shows you there's a whole presentation on it, and I just thought it was really, really interesting when I read through it. There's another thing. Oh, yeah, has anybody heard of Hedy Lamarr? Did I tell that one?
No.
Well, Hedy Lamarr was a movie star, and she's real pretty, but she was very, very smart. She did a couple of things. One of them was to create a torpedo control system that would work in the water, and she also invented something called frequency hopping. And it basically says, I'm going to be on this frequency for just a short amount of time. Then I go over to this frequency, which is a ways away, and then maybe between them somewhere. And it would have 40 or 50 frequencies, and it would continually jump between them all in a pattern that was duplicatable wherever they were going. But what they found was that the noise level on each of those varied quite a bit. And through statistical analysis and running through some algorithms, they could knock down the the noise level and have a better signal-to-noise ratio. And every single cell phone that you guys are hearing me on or you're talking on uses that nowadays. And it's like, oh, yeah, sure, we use it all the time. It's gotten more sophisticated, but it's the same stuff. So I just thought that was a nice little anecdote. Okay, anybody else check in or would like to speak?
The minute you started talking about that, I remembered it was in the ham material.
Yes, it was.
Very interesting because, maybe 20 years ago, that same sort of information turned up in the sonar community, and they used it there, where they called it hop codes. They hopped from one frequency to another, and does exactly the same sort of thing, but does it rather automatically, and so on, computerized, of course. So, very interesting topic. Over.
Okay, thank you for that input, Jan. Anybody else want to check in or have a question? Call now.
North Carolina Rick.
Well, hi, John. We're glad you're here. Anything you want to say?
North Carolina Rick.
Oh, hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Great, great.
We're glad to hear you sound like you're a long ways off.
Well, I'm trying to get closer to the microphone.
Oh, that makes a big difference. Thank you. Do you have anything you'd like to input this week or questions you'd like to ask or anything at all?
No, not really. Just Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Well, we're glad everybody showed up. This is kind of an odd time between the holiday, two holidays on the ends of the week. And we're glad everybody took the time to come on out and see all and participate in the call. Thank you. I would like to encourage you to keep going, keep doing. Anybody learn anything interesting this week? Anybody want to have an input?
Terry, if not, no one else has a question, can you talk some more? I didn't quite understand the turning on the AC signal and generating the energy and covering every single frequency. I'm not sure I understood that.
Okay. Do you know what a square wave is as opposed to a sinusoidal wave?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A square wave, if you start taking it down and looking at the components, what you find is that it's every odd harmonic of the frequency, the base frequency that you have, and any transmission device that instantly jumps to a frequency has a very, very steep curve, including those spark gap transmitters. And so they were really, really noisy, and they would hit whatever frequency they were on, they would hit all the odd harmonics of every frequency above and below it. It was just awful. And so though it would go clean across the country and across the ocean, it caused a lot of interference, and that meant that only the strongest stations could get through, and even then they were all being interfered with each other, so you couldn't tell where one ended and one began. Does that kind of fill it in for you?
Well, I always understood a spark gap to be like the spark plug in my car or my lawnmower or my chain.
Those are examples, but what they used to do is they'd have a little ball on the end of a couple of probes, and they would bend those together where they were real close. And when that spark gap was on, you were transmitting. When there was a spark across that gap, you were transmitting. And when the spark wasn't there, you weren't transmitting. And
so
that
was in the ball with some sort of a gas inside the ball?
No, it was out in the air.
Okay.
And that was what they used. That's what Marconi used for quite a while until they got a little bit better and the equipment improved and you had a little technology going into the thing.
Okay, I must have misunderstood you about the ball.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't quite say all of it before. I got myself onto a bunch of other things.
But so they generate, you plug it into an AC outlet? And
they weren't very electrified back then. Somebody had to be generating it. So you found your own way to generate the AC to drive the things. And like Jan was saying, if you put electronics, I wish I had a whiteboard here. Think of a circuit that comes in, splits off into two wires. One goes to a capacitor and one goes to a coil. And then the other side, it comes off the coil. One lead comes off the coil, one lead comes off the capacitor, and you're tied together and it keeps on going. That's called a tank circuit. And depending upon what values you choose for capacitance and inductance, it has a certain frequency to it. And if you tune those to a particular frequency and then pump an AC wave in there, it all has to be AC, you get various things out the other end, one of which is that you can get a pretty good set of frequencies that will drive that spark gap. And that's what they did. A lot of antennas nowadays that do multiple bands, they will have a little wide spot in the aerial up there. When you look at the elements of the antenna, there's a few of them with wide spots on the antenna. It's like a cylinder that's a little bigger than the antenna portion. And usually what they do is they put a tank circuit in there, a mix of capacitance and inductance, so that at one frequency you're using the full length of the antenna. But at another frequency, you're not using the full length of antenna. You're only going out to where that filter is, and the filter's grounding the rest of the signal, so it doesn't use that. And because that controls the link that tunes the antenna to the different frequency that you're using. And that way, they put up an antenna that has those filters on it, and it works across two or three bands instead of just one band. And yeah, I got way deep. I'm sorry. But does that make any sense?
Well, I'm starting to understand it. You didn't get very deep. I would like you to get deeper, but this is great. Thank you.
Okay. Well, if you want deeper, we can go deeper, but I don't want to lose everybody.
I understand. I'm going to look up tank circuits and see if I can learn anything and then go.
Yeah, I wonder if I did a search on tank circuits, what I would get. Probably something about World War II tanks.
Probably, yeah.
Tank circuits. LC circuit, Wikipedia. Ooh, LC circuit is what they call a tank. And that the L stands for
inductance,
and the C stands for capacitance. And they're resonance depending upon what the C and the L are. So I'm looking at the Wikipedia for LC in capital letters circuit. And there's a really good diagram there of what an inductor and a capacitor tied together are. And there's a whole bunch of different laws, and then we get into the operation. Oh, there's a nice little graphic that spins up and shows that as the voltage flows one way, the capacitor charges up. When it stops, the capacitor starts discharging through the inductor. And the inductor starts building a magnetic field with the current that's passing from the capacitor. Then the capacitor eventually runs out of gas. It uses up all the charge that is stored. Well, inductors don't like to have a change in current. So what the inductor does is, well, I'm going to trade some of this magnetism I created and push the circuit the other way. And it does. Well, that has the effect of charging up the capacitor on the right-hand side. If everybody wants to jump on and look at LC circuits or Wikipedia, that's a pretty good diagram that it's got. It's animated. So you can see the current flowing one way and the current flowing the other way. And what happens is you see the top part that's connecting the inductor and the capacitor. If you imagine a wire coming off of there and a wire coming off the bottom, that tank circuit can do a lot of things for you. For one thing, your current is maximum on a tank circuit anytime it's in resonance. And any signal that's not in resonance, the higher signals will go through the capacitor and go right on through. And any lower frequencies, the inductor will take them and pass them right on through without slowing down. And so there's all kinds of tank circuits like that in different places and a lot of radio equipment. And then you can read all about it. Is anybody looking at that?
I ordered a new computer, Terry, so I'm sorry. I can't look at it. I would love to look
at it. That's okay.
It's going to be coming by Friday, I think.
Resonance, I talked to one time about resonance, and it's extremely important because all of this stuff, every electrical circuit has electrical resonance at some frequency, and that might be zero. But it's resonant at a particular frequency. And the trick is to make it resonant at the frequency you want and not resonant at the frequencies you don't want. And there's some formulas on that page. And you can use those formulas to plug in, figure out what the values of the frequency. There's one that says the frequency is equal to your total inductance over 2 pi, and that goes out to 1 over the inverse of 2 pi times the square root of LC, which, and L is your inductance in farads and C is your capacitance, or your capacitive reactants. So this is all very fun, and I haven't looked at it in years. So,
right.
Any other questions? Resonant frequency. So the resonant frequency is equal to 1 over the square root of L times C. And it goes through all the math, and it's not that hard. And then there's a series LC circuit down here a little further. This is interesting because a series LC circuit at its resonant frequency will pass. And so what you're doing with all these filters is you're putting in the filter you need. So you wire it up to where if you don't want it, you want to dunk a frequency right there. You put it so it goes through a tank circuit. If you want only this frequency, you put an LC circuit that's in series, and it only passes the resonant frequency of that value of inductance L and that value of capacitance C. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay, I got one yes. That means I've got three people saying, what in the world is she talking about?
I have to follow you on the page, so I'll...
Yeah, I'm sorry you don't have a live computer
right now.
I hope that you write down LC underscore circuit. So look up Wikipedia and look up LC circuit.
Oh, I have five pages of notes, Terry. I've been writing.
Okay. And there's the parallel LC circuit. So it tells you the basic tank circuit, which is the when they're wired parallel, and the series LC circuit. And they got all of them. Then they get into some big formulas at the bottom that I haven't got a clue on. Oh, here we go. The first evidence that a capacitor and an inductor could produce electrical oscillations was discovered in 1826 by French scientist Félix Savary. He found that when a Leyden jar, which is a static electricity jar, was discharged through a wire wound around an iron needle, sometimes the needle was left magnetized in one direction and sometimes the opposite direction. He correctly deduced that this was caused by a damped oscillating discharge current in the wire, which reversed the magnetization of the needle back and forth until it was too small to have an effect, leaving the needle magnetized in the random direction. Okay, I'm going to stop right there because we're probably losing people. I don't want to lose anybody. I want to talk at a level where everybody can understand and everybody can see this. But you get reading this stuff, and it's amazing how they use their heads. And, you know, one of the things that I'm sure happened is that we didn't have TV back then. And because of that, people had to use their time at night when they couldn't work the crops to do something. And they would do it. They would work on this stuff. The first patent for a radio system that allowed tuning was filed by Lodge in 1897, although the first practical systems were invented in 1900 by Italian radio pioneer Guglielmo Marconi. And I'm sure you've heard of Guglielmo Marconi. Okay.
By the way, they sell those Leyden jars on eBay. I forget what
you can make. You can make one if you want to go to the trouble. I mean, it's just a bolt and put it on the top. You put two strips of aluminum foil. And the bigger the charge, the more the foil will separate. So that would be a good exercise. And, you know, it's fun talking to kids about ham radio because when you teach them at that age, they learn it for life. And they're not afraid to jump into this stuff. We had Bart Juniors and about 180 or more, 200, I can't remember how many kids it were, got there. Ham license through Bart Jr. I helped teach many of them. And there was a chunk of them that went to NASA because they already knew electronics at a very young age. And, you know, it all depends on the person. But wouldn't it be nice to give them that opportunity? If they wanted to get into that, they could. Okay. I think unless somebody else has a question or they want to say something, I think that's about all the time we've got right now. Anybody else? Any late check-ins? Anything? Okay, that being not the case, then I will say it's time to close it down. This has been the NLA Hams Net. This net is held at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every week on a Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And we welcome anybody who's interested to come and talk a little bit about radio, learning to take the test, how to get your ham license, and how having a license, ham license, radio amateur license, can help with your committee of safety or committee of correspondence and support the NLA. And with that, we're very thankful for everyone's participation tonight, and we look forward to hearing you again next Wednesday. And that is now closed.